The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Habit 2. Begin with the end in mind.
See, habit 1 basically says, you're the programmer. You with me? Mm-hmm. You're the programmer. Habit 2, which we call begin with the end in mind, means write the program. See, if you're the programmer, then write it. Don't just live some other program that you don't feel meets your needs and your values. You write it. Habit 3, live it. We call it put first things first. Live the program. Now, in a sense, habit 1 is the habit of personal vision. You gain a vision or a sense. I am not an animal. I have this internal power to choose, and I can choose on the basis of my values. But notice, that assumes values. That assumes a self-chosen value system. That's what habit 2 is. Habit 2 is the habit of personal leadership. It's based upon that vision. But it's the program that you write for yourself. You take leadership in your own life. Habit 1 tells you you can do it. Habit 2 tells you what's the direction you're going in. That's the habit of personal leadership. You lead your life. You decide the program. You decide your value system. What's habit 3? It's the habit of personal management. Put first things first. Once I decide what I am about and what I value, now I have to do it. I have to organize myself and actually execute around those priorities, around those values. That is day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month management. You see the difference between leadership and management? Leadership deals with direction, values. Leadership is like the top line of an organization, the top line of a person's life. What am I about? What do I value? Management deals with how do I accomplish that efficiently. It's a bottom line focus and orientation. Let's look at it in another way. Habit 1 says you're the creator. Habit 2 is the first creation. Habit 3 is the second creation. Let me show you. When you build a house, you create it in every detail and reduce that entire plan to a blueprint. And yet the earth has not yet been touched. Is this not right? You have every detail. There isn't one exception. Everything is spelled out before the earth is even touched. If there are exceptions, they're called expensive change orders later. The carpenter's rule is measure twice, cut once. You've got to make sure that the blueprint, the first creation, is really what you want, and you've thought everything through. Each day, you go to the construction shed and you pull out the blueprint, and it gives you your marching orders. You begin that day with the end in mind. Everything you do, in a sense, has an end in its mind, whether you put that there or not. That's the first creation. It's the first creation. All things are created twice. Everything. You have a project you're undertaking. You have to envision it. Get a clear sense of what it's about, what your goals are, your plans to achieve them, before you execute it. Then you have to execute it. That's the habit of putting first things first, which means you organize and execute around your priorities, around your values, around the first creation. I hope you can begin to sense how these 3 habits are interwoven together. They literally are inseparable. If you were to only teach proactivity, people could get a sense of their nature, their power to choose, But if you didn't get them into the exercises of habits 2 and 3, which develop those proactivity muscles, they'll flop about and they'll fall back, and their proactivity muscles will remain dormant, latent within them. They won't really develop their potential. Now, the later habits are people habits. How you use your proactive muscles and habits 2 and 3 to work effectively with other people. You have to be patient, because we don't want to get ahead of ourselves and deal with people issues too early until we understand habits 1, 2, and 3. Because as we taught earlier, until people have a high degree of self-mastery and self-control, it would be difficult, if not impossible, for them in stressful social situations to be effective. They'll just have a tendency to just live out ineffective programs. For instance, some may ask, well, how do you proactively confront somebody else? How do you give feedback to somebody else? Who needs the feedback? See, that is a social question, but it assumes internal self-control, internal self-mastery. And it's a very, very good question. But you can't really teach someone calculus till they understand algebra, or algebra till you understand basic math. Some things come ahead of other things. You could say to the person, learn to first be patient and empathize with the person you want to give feedback to. Examine your own motive to make sure that you're not doing an ego trip on them. Make sure you put deposits into the emotional bank account. Then when you give the feedback, give it within their frame of reference and in their language and in a time and place that would make it optimally effective for them to buy into the feedback, or at least to seriously consider it. But if a person has not developed enough self-mastery and self-control, see, and then they want to try to give feedback, they'd probably violate all of those principles and just flop all over the place, simply because they don't have the internal self-control to do those other things. You can see the point. Independence, personal independence, is the foundation of interdependence. Now, sometimes you're in situations where you don't need to be interdependent. Then you can just act out your independent capacities. But if you are in situations that require cooperation, teamwork, interdependence, the independent person has the power to work on those situations. The dependent person cannot, because the dependent person is too controlled by other people. See my point? He's empowered other people's weaknesses. That's why people hesitate to give feedback. They're afraid, if I give the feedback, I'll blow it. I just as soon not rupture the relationship, so I won't say anything. Then they have to live with saying nothing. So their circle of influence stays small. You always work on the outside edge of the circle of influence to make it get larger. Have you ever climbed a ladder of success, really worked hard at it, one rung after another, and when you got to the top, you realized it was leaning against the wrong wall? Now, what's that a failure in? Management or leadership? Leadership. Management is climbing efficiently up that ladder of success. Leadership deals with, is it leaning against the right wall? Is that where you want to be? See, leadership deals with direction. Management deals with speed and efficiency and doing what's necessary to take that direction. Some people's lives are well managed but poorly led. And sometimes the opposite. Well led, poorly managed. They're two different capacities. And I wanted to get across the sense that these next two habits deal with leadership and management. Both are extremely important, but always leadership first. Why? You want to know where you're going first before you discuss the issues of how to get there, and before you implement your plan, see? Now, I'd like to use a term that I think is common and that you can relate to. Scripting. Scripting. We usually think of a script like a role that some people are given in a play, and they learn their lines and so forth. Well, it's not too unlike that, really. We get scripted in our life, in our upbringing, and by the circumstances. The proactivity principle teaches us that we can rewrite the script. But until we rewrite the script, what script do we live out? The script we've been given by our upbringing, by other people's agendas, by the pressures of circumstances, or by maybe intergenerational tendencies, see, that we have just kind of absorbed and inherited, not just biologically, but culturally, socially. We get scripted. So if I'm serious about providing personal leadership to my life, begin every day with the end in mind. Begin every project with the end in my mind, with the values and where I'd like to be, the direction I want to go in. If I'm serious about that, and I recognize scripts that are in me, habits, old ways of doing things, old methods that are ineffective, you can see that I've got a problem. I've got to get out those old scripts and put new ones in. I've got to re-script myself. Now, really, this is not a far-out notion. If I were trying to become, let's say, a car mechanic, I would need to go and get some education and get some hands-on education as well until I understood the theory and the principles, and then I could gradually begin to develop the practices to find and fix problems. What is that process? I'm getting a new script. If I'm learning the language of Spanish, I would need to take a Spanish course, use it as much as I can, get with a Spanish teacher, use it, practice, back and forth. Gradually, I'm getting a script in my head. I've always been inspired by studying the life of Anwar Sadat and sensing the monumental contribution that he made in that Bold Peace Initiative, which eventually brought about the Camp David Accord. Here was a person who had been reared, nurtured, and deeply inbred in the script of hating Israel. In fact, he would make statements like this: I will never shake the hand of an Israeli as long as they occupy 1 inch of Arab soil. Never, never, never. And in huge congregations all around the country, as he would do this on national television, there would be the chanting, never, never, never. In other words, to marshal the energy and unify the will of a whole country in that script. And he knew it was a stupid script. Why is it stupid? Because they're interdependent. And to try to talk independently in an interdependent reality is like playing golf with a tennis racket. The tool isn't suited to the reality at all. And he knew it. So he re-scripted himself. He learned when he was a young man in a solitary confinement cell in prison, Cairo Central Prison, cell 19, when he was a young man, to re-script his head. He drew heavily upon his own religious system and upon the practice of meditation and prayer. In fact, when you saw pictures of Anwar Sadat, you saw on his forehead a dark, heavier dark spot. That came from the daily habit of kneeling and putting his forehead on a pillow. And often it involved hours every day. He learned in that solitary confinement situation over a long period of time how to vacate an old script, how to leave it alone and write a new one. He learned how to build an internal resiliency toward anything that was happening to him. In fact, he was almost loath, he records in his autobiography, to leave the prison cell, because he realized that success is success with self. It's not in having things. It's in the mastery and victory over self. And even though he was happy to leave from the point of view of liberties, he was loath to leave the place where he learned so much about personal leadership, using my language now. But he did it. And over the years, he continued to practice his basic skills and his powers to re-script his head. For a period of time during Nassar's administration, he was relegated to a position of relative insignificance, and everyone felt that his spirit was broken. But it wasn't. They were projecting. They didn't understand Sadat. He was biding his time with a smile inside. When his time came and he became the president of Egypt, he re-scripted his head toward Israel. And then he visited the Knesset in Tel Aviv and proposed the peace initiative, which Begin responded to and led to the Camp David Accord. Really one of the great, some people could consider, miracles in modern political history. Coming out of an embroiled area where the feelings are so deep, so intergenerational. I'll tell you a couple of exercises that are helpful in thinking about it. Put yourself in a larger perspective. Stand apart from your life. Stand at a distance. For instance, attend your own funeral. What would you like the eulogy to say about you and the whole audience to resonate to? As a neighbor, take the different roles. Neighbor. Professional. Professional worker, see? Church worker. Public servant. Community worker. Volunteer person. How would you like them to describe your character? What would you like to be able to contribute? You know what? Now think of your different roles. Let's say you're a salesperson or you're a manager. You may be a product developer or a combination of all three of those. There's three different roles in your work life. See, they're roles. But you could think in the larger role, the role of being a worker, a professional, the role of my occupation. That's a role. What am I about in that area? And what are the values that should guide me? Think of your personal roles. Father or mother, husband or wife, neighbor, friend, cousin, son, daughter, brother, sister. Think of the extended family. Think of the intergenerational family, and that'll produce some personal roles. What are you about in those roles? What's important to you? Is family unity? Is integrity with your brothers and sisters? Think of community roles. Maybe in the political area, or in public service, or in volunteer organizations. In other words, you have a number of different roles in your life. So when you think about your mission, think about your roles, the different roles that you have. And then think about your goals. Your goals. In each of those roles. And you can break the goals into lifelong ones if you want, or intermediate or short-term ones. Essentially, a goal is kind of the end, see? The end. Where you want to end up in this particular role. That's a goal. Key is to balance roles and goals and to put them under a wider perspective, mission, vision. Values, the larger values, see, of what the essence of my life is about and what is it I value that will never be changed. It's not changing. It never changes. As you grow and mature, you might change it, but it changes with great difficulty. You see, people can't live with change if there's not a changeless core inside them. The key to the ability to change is a deep core that doesn't change. It's a changeless core. A changeless sense of who I am, what I am about, and what I value. When that doesn't change, you can flow with changes. You don't need prejudgments or prejudices. The speed of change is accelerating, and many people are really kind of burned out by it, and they can hardly handle it. They can hardly cope with life. Then they get into the reactive frame of mind, and they have capitulated. They've essentially given up. And just hope that things will happen to them that are good, that they can hardly cope with anything else. That's why it's so important to develop a personal mission statement out of which you think through your roles, and then for each of the roles to think through some goals. Now let's see where we are now. If we develop a mission, a mission. Statement of some kind made up of two basic elements. What am I about? And then, my values. What is it I value? Then you take that into thinking through each of your roles, and then attach goals in each of those roles. And you think through the different roles of your life. Then you have to take that down into the specific activities. You could call them short-term goals, if you wish, that will enable you to accomplish those goals in each of those roles. All of which helps to fulfill the mission and actualize the values contained within it. If you can understand that process, you'll understand the process that produces integrity. Well, not completely, though, because it's the living it, the implementing of it, that produces the integrity. But at least there is integrity between your ultimate values and mission with your roles and goals and your short-term goals or activities or plans, you might call them, to accomplish those. That is an integrity in the first creation. But if people are reactive and they get their scripts or programs from other people and they're incongruent with the values that they really hold deep inside, you can see that already there's an internal duplicity, an internal breakdown that has taken place. That's why it is so important to think carefully about this. By the way, when I work with organizations, one of the most important thrusts of that work is to assist the organization or encourage them to develop a mission statement. What is this organization about, and what does it value? As the changeless core, I also recommend it for departments within that organization. I also recommend it for marriages, for families. Then you will find that you gradually build into people's heads and hearts a frame of reference, a set of criteria or guidelines that they will all govern themselves by. And they themselves have helped develop it, see? So that they don't need someone from the outside taking pot shots at them, criticizing them, directing them, controlling them. There's a shared value system there which is embodied in some kind of a statement that they all have bought into. The essence of it to testify of their proactive nature, that they themselves can become independent of you and that you can empower them instead of making them dependent upon you. Affirm them. You can do it. That's the exciting part about it, because, see, most people are a function of the social mirror. The social mirror of the opinions, the perceptions, the paradigms of people around them. And they're just reacting to it. Most people's data about themselves comes from the social mirror. And if there's an accumulative agreement between leaders and teachers and parents and friends, this is the kind of person you are. Most people internally adopt that. And that becomes their script. See? In fact, I'll bet there are a number of people in this room right here now that have had people believe in you when you didn't believe in yourself. And they scripted you. How many have had that experience? You were willing to give up on yourself, or you became very discouraged, and you think, that's me, that's the way I am, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm Capricorn. You know, that's my astrological sign. That has dictated the parameters of my life. Sick, sick, sick. Nevertheless, argue for your weakness, and it's yours. You'll get into the self-fulfilling prophecy. But what if you could be an affirmer of other people at the crossroads of their life, where they could go one direction or another, where they're being fed by the social mirror to take the lower path, and you inspire them toward the higher path because you believe in them, and you make deposits of love, and you empathize, and you listen to them, but you don't sympathize with them. You don't absolve them of responsibility, but you simply communicate to them, you've got the power to do it, and I'm with you, and I will help you. How many have seen that movie, Man of La Mancha, or the gone to the play? Remember that beautiful story about this romantic medieval knight, you know, that comes in contact with this woman of the street, this prostitute, and she's being so validated by all of the people of her life, see? But he sees in her something else. He provides leadership for her life. He starts making deposits. He sees her loveliness. He sees her beauty. He sees her virtue. And he affirms it over and over again to her. She denies it utterly. So contrary to all the other social mirrors. And she writes him off as some, you know, wild-eyed fantasizer. But he's persistent. His love is unconditional. He's proactive. He doesn't judge what he does on the basis of does it work or not. He judges it on the basis of it's right or not. And he persists, see? Gradually it penetrates the script, this mortal overlay, down into her true nature. And she starts to respond to it. Little by little, imperceptibly, she begins to change her lifestyle. And she believes it and acts that way. All to the dismay of everyone else. She begins to backslide a little. He calls her to his deathbed and sings that beautiful ballad, you know, The Impossible Dream. Looks her in the eye, brings her close to him. Says, never forget your Dulcinea. Her name had been Aldonza. Never forget your Dulcinea. He'd given her a new name, a new paradigm associated with the new name. Never forget it. That is exciting. Think about your children that way. Think about an employee. My friends, isn't that an exciting idea? That you could be other people's first creation? Hopefully to make them independent of you and fulfilled within themselves? Just like many people were to you and to me when we were on another road. Someone made a deposit. I believe in you. You can do it. That is so exciting to me. That is so inspiring. You imagine the contributions you could make in life if that became part of your mission? The lives you could help and benefit as a leader, as a manager, as a teacher, as a parent, as a worker, whatever. Habit two is thinking carefully through the whole process and then visualizing the end and have it in your mind, clearly in your mind. Visualize. How do you handle stress? How do you handle difficulties or fatigue or disappointment or a lack of cooperation? You fly off the handle? Do you lose your cool? Does it get into your spirit? You wrap your emotional life around that person's weakness? See yourself. Visualize clearly. Let's say in your mission statement, you value integrity. Can you see yourself under compromising situations? Say no, that's it. See yourself treating people with dignity. People who don't treat you with dignity. Can you see yourself doing it? If you live out of your memory, you live out of your history. That's what once was. If you live out of your imagination, you live out of your potential. That's what can be.
This is the end of side five.